18th, about 12:45 in the afternoon. It's going to be another one of those long, long hot days. Temperature got up to 105 yesterday. They're expecting the same today. I went out and did a few things this morning, but right now I'm bored again. I went to the video store and I got some tapes. I got Lawrence of Arabia, which I plan to look at tonight, but I got that old pot boiler called Wings, featuring, I guess, Clara Bow and Richard Arlen and Buddy Rogers, and there was also a little bit of Gary Cooper in there. It's an old silent film. It won an award for, well, an Academy Award for Best Picture back in the 20s sometime, I guess, but it's really not too good. I just switched it off. I didn't watch it all. I bought it for the flying scenes, which weren't bad, but the rest of it is really archaic. I must say the acting today is so much better than it was back then. Anyway, being bored, I'm going to continue with a few of those stories, assuming that you've been listening to the ones I've sent you. And I wish you'd do me a favor, if you would, please. Either retape what I send you and let me have I'd like to have the tapes back, if you don't mind. If you want to keep them, I guess you can tape them. Because I think I will keep all these tapes and make copies of them. And I have a nephew, I think, that would like to have a copy of them. But if you can, tape them and send me back the tapes. Anyway, I listened to some of the tapes I made, and I noticed there might be a few places in there where you'd be confused and wonder what happened next. I remember I was telling you about that rock ape I had that I used to take with me on trips out into areas, and he was a lot of company. Of course, he was a nuisance. Some GIs gave him to me because he was just too much of a nuisance, too hard to handle. And although I had people working for me, like guards around the house and whatnot, and I had banana trees that we could chain them to, and the guards could feed them and whatnot, he was a handful and was a nuisance. He's kind of like a mean-tempered dog. And I eventually had to get rid of him. We used to fly down to Khanasan Island. This is a series of islands off the coast of the tip of South Vietnam. As a matter of fact, you probably heard of the prison colony they had there. It was much like Devil's Island in French, off the coast of South America, Cayenne, the French colonies that was there at one time, down around Suriname. Anyway, there's a series of islands down there, and on one of the islands they had a beautiful landing strip. It was black lava, sand, and palm trees. It was really like a paradise in the South China Sea. And there were some GIs that had a radio station on top of one of the mountains or hills down there. And they said they wanted the ape, and one time I flew it down there and gave him my rock ape. I found out later that he was just too mean and too hard to handle, and they had to get rid of him. Nobody wanted him, so they took him and blindfolded him and tied him to a stake and machine gunned him, just like they would execute just like prisoners were executed one time, I guess. But anyway, that was the end of my rock ape. Another time I had a small macaque monkey that an American missionary had given to me. And he was a cute, lovable little thing, and he liked to travel with me. Except that he wanted to sit on top of my head rather than on the back of the seat or something like that. He just loved sitting on top of my head. And from time to time, while sitting on the top of my head, he would do nasty little things. And I thought, well, maybe this will make my hair grow. It never did, but I eventually had to get rid of him, too. It's just kind of a nuisance. And I didn't want him impose my responsibilities like that on some poor hapless employee. So eventually I got rid of that monkey too. I had the ape, maybe for 3 or 4 weeks. I had the monkey for maybe a month. But they were a great deal of amusement and company, especially on weekends. I'm going to tell you about the enemy in Vietnam. I don't know how many people agree with me. I guess it depends on their experience over there. And while it's true that the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese could be a threat to life and limb, there are other hazards over there as well. Of course, one of the biggest hazards for those stationed around Saigon or some of the major cities like Nha Trang, around Cameron Bay or places like that, urban areas, were the Vietnamese women. The Vietnamese women, of course, are very attractive, and most of them were looking for, many of them were the daughters of struggling peasants, and they were looking for a way out, and they'd zero in on some poor hapless American, be he a civilian or a GI. And of course, many of them, I know, actually married these Americans, and perhaps even today are better off for it. For a few people like myself working with the mountain yards, the mountain yard women could be a hazard. The fact that these people couldn't read or write didn't mean that they were stupid. And many of them had very beguiling personalities, were very lovable women who I guess would make somebody a fine companion or wife. So I rated the enemy, first threat to doing in were the Vietnamese women, and then for a few people like myself who worked up in the Central Highlands, the mountain yard women could be a threat. For people who lived or worked in and around Saigon or were stationed at places like Long Binh, these huge military complexes, another threat were American women. Now, American women came in two distinct types. You had young women who had signed on with the government, say as secretaries and typists or what have you, with the State Department or the Agencies for International Development or the American Information Program, or who worked for one of the huge construction firms that operated all throughout Vietnam. Most of them were young, inexperienced. They thought everything was a big adventure, and they were meeting the most wonderful captain or major or whatever for the first time in their life, and there were parties. And you must understand that people working for the U.S. government in Vietnam lived far better than they ever could at home. The U.S. government bought, built, and rented apartment houses, hotels, villas, and whatnot from the Vietnamese. Everybody who went over there had their own apartment or house, all furnished. They were given allowances to buy drapes and whatnot. There was a huge organization, I forget what they call it, operated by the State Department that sees to that everybody has a working air conditioner, and washing machine, refrigerator, and all that. They lived high on the hog. So a lot of these young girls, away from home and in an environment like that, could do a man in if he didn't watch himself. And then there's another class of women over there. They were inclined to be older women. Most of them were associated with the government one way or another, worked with the State Department or one of the other agencies, or with one of the big construction companies. And most of these women were like executive secretaries. Most of them are very competent in office type work and whatnot. But I'm sure that a lot of them were old battle axes working in and around Washington that somebody was just damn glad to get rid of. And I think a lot of these old gals realize that they're nearing the end of their tether and they better go off and do something exciting or get that one last promotion before they put out the pasture. But they were hard and tough as nails, and most of them, of course, worked for the generals and the directors and whatnot, and they wielded a lot of power within their organization. But some of them were real bitches. And then far down on the list you had American truck drivers. Now, what I'm saying is not always true, but in the American military, it seems to me that the people who became truck drivers or worked in the motor pool were those who didn't score too highly on their aptitude tests or had little or no experience in civilian life. And they're inclined to be kind of wild and reckless. I'm thinking of these guys now that drove the trucks and convoys and whatnot. Now, understand, I'm generalizing. You'd find all kinds, but generally speaking, they weren't the highest type you'll find in the military. And behind the wheel of a truck or a tank, they could be dangerous. A lot of people got run over by trucks and tanks. And I guess you know about convoys. If a convoy is underway, they stop for nothing. Even if they hit somebody, they keep on going. And then, of course, you had the Vietnamese truck drivers who were even lower down on the list as far as I was concerned. The average Vietnamese truck driver was a peasant lad who was taken from the back of a water buffalo and given maybe a couple hours or little training in driving the truck or what have you. And next thing you know, he's behind the wheel of a powerful vehicle and he's almost omnipotent. And they were a real threat. So when people would ask me about the dangers in Vietnam, I would very often tell them it was the Vietnamese women, the mountain yard women, the American women in Saigon, the American truck driver, the Vietnamese truck driver, and then maybe you could say the Viet Cong and perhaps the North Vietnamese. Because I know a lot of good men who are done in by some of these groups I'm mentioning long before the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese got to them. Now you must realize, Ali, I'm not talking from personal experience. But when I was over there, I was close to 50. You might say I was, if not over the hill, I was approaching the crest. But I'm an observant person, and I observed a lot of what was going on, and what I just related to you is part of my overall observations, not based on my overall experience. I know that when I first went to Vietnam, I was under the mistaken impression that housing was very difficult to come by, that I'd probably be living on a sampan in the Saigon River if I was lucky enough to find a spot. And I was just absolutely dumbfounded to find all the Americans living in these beautiful apartments and hotels and houses. The first month or so I was there, I was given a room in the Regina Hotel on Pasteur Street, brand new hotel built by the wealthy Vietnamese to cash in on the prosperity that was rolling around. And then I was given a villa. On Pasteur Street. And this was in Vietnam and around the cities anyway, you found people even back then living far better than you're living right now, Ali, or far better than I'm living here. Beautiful homes, beautiful gardens, large homes. I was given one of these homes. It had an iron fence around it. It had four bedrooms and three baths. It had a living room and dining room and a kitchen downstairs, all beautifully tiled. The living room was so big that one time I had a party there, and we even had bicycle races in the living room. I inherited three maids with the house. And this was during the period of time when I was the refugee operations officer, where I traveled from one end of Vietnam to the other, reacting to various refugee problems. Whenever there's military action, be it created by the Americans, the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, or the North Vietnamese, I had to go make certain that something was being done by the people in the province. And it was rather eerie. I would get up in the morning in this big house I'm telling you about, and the maids used to buy American goods on the black market. I would sit at this big long table, and I'd have bacon and eggs and orange juice and toast and coffee for breakfast. A car, chauffeur-driven car, would pick me up and take me out to Tan Son Nhut Airport. I'd get on an airplane and I might be flown up to the area in and around Da Nang or even further up, where I'd be met by American and Vietnamese refugee officials, and we'd go by international scout or maybe helicopter out way out some godforsaken place where there's nothing but death and destruction and refugees and dead and dying and disabled people and whatnot. Around 4:30 I'd be picked up and flown back to Saigon, 400 miles away, and be home for supper that night. It was rather eerie, and I didn't like that at all. Later on, when I got a chance to go with John Van, as his director of refugees in 3 Corps, and later 2 Corps, I did, and I was living in less pretentious places, and wasn't living so close to the bureaucracy that existed in Saigon. And mentioning bureaucracy, I'll tell you what eventually happened. When I first went over there working for the overseas mission, we had a great deal of autonomy. We had the keys to the warehouses. We could control the distribution of commodities. Later on, as the war became more involved and more American troops came over and the more and more bureaucrats from the military and Washington came over, there's this interim organization called OCAL that I mentioned before, the Office of Civil Operations. It was kind of a stopgap organization in which they infiltrated Army personnel into our units. When I first went over there, we were all civilians, working with civilians, by civilians, for civilians. Under OCAL, suddenly I am the supervisor of several majors and colonels and sergeants and typists and stenographers and whatnot, all with the Army. And of course, I think I mentioned before that we all had a very high rank. We'd have a rank at least equivalent to a full colonel, because we were writing the performance ratings on the people who worked for us, and of course a lot of them were majors and colonels. But the Army was integrated into what we were doing, and suddenly we're spending as much time writing personnel reports and commendations for people as we were doing anything else. Later on, when the organization became CORD, Civil Operation Revolutionary Development and Support, we were subordinate to the goddamn Army. And this meant that we had to live at province headquarters with the province senior advisor, who was the colonel. We had to get up in the morning and stand formation. This is a group of civilians along with the colonels and the majors and the sergeants and whatnot. We had to attend staff meetings. We had to give briefings. We had to prepare briefing charts. And it became a typical bureaucratic, nonsensical exercise. It reminded me a lot of those little devices I used to buy at these roadside stands along the Texas highways, where they sell gewgaws to tourists. And they used to sell a little wooden device that was with a handle on it. You'd turn the handle and gears would move and wheels would rotate, but nothing would happen. It was called a bullshit grinder. Well, after 650,000 troops came to Vietnam, and it became, and we all came under CORDS, were just part of the military buildup, it seemed to me we spent all our time turning the handle on the bullshit grinder. I lost track of the number of organizations and units that were pulled together. It was always amazing to me how you could take a bare spot of ground and start putting people on it who theoretically are supposed to have some kind of a sacred or secret mission, important mission. You can never figure out what it is. Next thing you know, they have a headquarters staff and they have offices and they have a chaplain and they have all the functionaries you'll find on any town or base. And all they're really doing, actually, is supporting themselves. And nothing tangible is being done. And towards the end, that's what I saw happen all too often. We were just turning the handle on the bullshit grinder. As I mentioned before, writing performance reports for these yo-yos at workforce. Somehow or another, everybody got a lot of commendations, and if you were to ask me what they did to win those commendations, why, I'd really be hard put to put my finger on it, but I wrote a lot of them nevertheless. And it wasn't much fun. And to add to all this, of course, were the bureaucrats in Saigon and Washington, D.C., both military and civilian. You know, the State Department is like the military. Let me talk about the military first. You're an ex-military officer, and so am I. And I think we both know that if you really wanted a fine career in the military, it'd be good to be from a traditional military dynasty, like many of them are today, from a wealthy family, get an appointment to West Point or the Naval Academy, become a member of the regular army, and of course, as time rolls on, you'll be promoted, and I guess we both know that wars are fought generally not by the planners who are professional people from the academies, but by the poor bastards they drag off the streets. There are exceptions to what I'm saying, but by and large, wars are fought by the run-of-the-mill person you pull off the street. In the Army, if you want to have the best career, it's best to be regular Army and graduate from the Academy and have family connections. In the State Department, it's much the same way. The State Department is made up, I mean, the hardcore of the State Department, these are mostly people who are from wealthy families who graduated from Ivy League colleges. They go with the State Department, and if they keep their nose clean and don't become controversial, they will serve in Paris and London and The Hague and other plush world capitals, and will eventually, by the time they're in midlife, have a respectable grade. The State Department treats its people well, has all kinds of perks. Your housing is furnished, and the houses are beautiful, because I've lived in some of them, especially when my family moved to Taiwan. You can send your children to foreign schools and whatnot, but it's a nice way to earn a living. And every once in a while, something will happen, like a war in Vietnam, or troubles in Bangladesh, or troubles in Laos or Cambodia. The State Department, rather than sending their foreign service officers, regular, will recruit foreign service officers reserve, just like the military calls in the reserves when there's dirty work to be done. And so, most of the people who worked in Vietnam, not all, but most of them, were foreign service reserve. And they come in with a respectable rank. I don't know if you know anything about the various types of ranking in the civilian and military hierarchy, but in the military, you know, you can go from apprentice seaman to admiral, and there's various grades in between. Or you can go from PFC to general. You can be, and again, there's grades in between, like say from brigadier general to major general, or from staff sergeant to tech sergeant to whatever it is now, master sergeant, senior master sergeant. In government circles, people go in with a GS rating. I guess that stands for government service, and usually start at probably about a 3, and it goes all the way up to GS-16 and the super grades, which are 17 and 18. And in the State Department, people generally enter at about, in the State Department, it's reversed. the lower the number, the higher you are. For example, at the top of the hierarchy in the State Department, these people are Foreign Service 1. I imagine Kissinger's a 1. John Vann was a 1. And of course, there's various steps. There's 4, step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4, and so forth. Anyway, most people in the Foreign Service get to be probably about a step 4, or maybe a 3 before they retire. And when they drag people in for the really dangerous jobs like Laos and Cambodia and whatnot, Vietnam, they come in with a high rank. I came in with a 4, and I made a 3 about the time I left. And that's a respectable rank. And the people in Washington give you that rank, expecting you to go off and do your thing, and hope that you'll do it and get out or get killed, one or the other. I know when John Vann would come back to Washington for reassignment, he was a 1, the people back there were beside themselves with panic. Somehow or another, they just couldn't quite conceive of somebody like John Vann being their superior. As a matter of fact, after I came home, I had to spend time in Washington like we all did, being what they call debriefed. That's where you give them all the information you have in your head, and then they, sitting in Washington, become the experts. But anyway, I was given 2 more chances to go back with the State Department, and one of them was when just before Cambodia collapsed. I had a chance to work in Cambodia, and maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I had a chance to go to Afghanistan. I would have been living in Islamabad, and again, housing was good there, and it wouldn't have been bad at all. Wouldn't be bad living, but of course, working in those dismal refugee camps would have been horrendous. Anyway, I didn't avail myself of the opportunity because at this stage of my life, I'm not going to do anything like that again. I'm too content being in my own environment, not having much to do every day except to entertain myself. Anyway, the State Department and the military were just a little bit too much there in Vietnam, and eventually Comer and Colby were hard-eyed bureaucrats, began to take the whole program and computerize it. I remember that Saigon was full of computers. They came out with what was called the HESS report, the Hamlet Evaluation System. And theoretically, advisors and agents out in the field were supposed to be feeding all this pertinent information about every hamlet in Vietnam. In reality, the only information that was valid were from those areas that were absolutely safe for people to live and work in. And those places out in the boonies where people said they would go in and make evaluations, but they seldom did. And this Hamlet evaluation system was a machine run that we all got every month. It must have been 1.5 feet thick of this folded IBM paper with every village on there, and it was broken down whether the people were Catholics or Buddhists or Wahao or Cao Dai, or how many were Viet Cong infrastructure, how many were Viet Cong, how many how many were this age, how many that age, how many males, how many females, and on and on and on and on. It would take, even if you had the information, it would take a team of accountants to do the damn thing right. And if you sent in your pest report that didn't jive with the overall policy, if they said things were getting better and your HES said they were getting worse, you got your HES report back to readjust. Because during this period of time, Westmoreland had promised the president that there was light at the end of the tunnel and things were getting better, and whether they're getting better or not, the HES report had to report this. So we spent an awful lot of time with that kind of bullshit. And it was utterly worthless. Christ, is it any wonder that Vietnam went down the tubes? It seemed to me that instead of going out and actively working with the people as we once did, we were all in our offices grinding out this bullshit and taking these machine runs, computer machine runs, and trying to readjust them to somebody's satisfaction. And it was all absolutely meaningless. And I knew that. I could feel it. And I lost an awful lot of enthusiasm. And I think in one of my stories I told you how Zoo's men came up behind me in that Jeep, and I strongly suspect they were trying to knock me off because we were trying to get rid of Zoo, and he didn't like what we were doing working with the mountain yards and whatnot. And there were 11 or 12 of us doing this kind of work, and we all were decimated. Some guys got, we don't know what happened to them. And Van got killed, and some people got killed in plane crashes, and a few were killed by mines and booby traps and whatnot. And to my knowledge, Ali, I'm alive, I think. And I think there's a guy out in Washington by the name of Hamburger, and a guy down south by the name of Dean Stanton, who left a little bit before I did. But to my knowledge, we're the only three that survived. Anyway, I want to bring you up to date on that story that about the Jeep. I told you how I went out to Mountain Yard Village and they hid my Jeep and then took me to the airport. I flew to Saigon. And from Saigon I flew back to Taiwan. And from Taiwan I came home. I was finished. It was a combination of being fed up with all the bureaucratic nonsense that we had to put up with, knowing that the whole effort was useless, knowing that we had no business being there in the first place and we weren't doing anybody any good at all. And initially, you know, I could do some good. I did help a lot of refugees, thousands upon thousands of them, but that was getting harder and harder to do, especially after the army and the bureaucrats took over. And I was kind of glad to get out of there when I did. And the only thing I can say that was done in Vietnam was that the highway was paved from the north to the south and east to the west. And it was done by this huge consortium, this construction company known as RMKBRJ. And Lyndon B. Johnson was a major stockholder in that company, I've been told. That's what the J stands for. But other than that, we didn't do a damn thing. We were like the people who think just because they stick their finger in a bucket of water that when they withdraw their finger, a hole is left there. There's no hole, there's nothing. And everything that we did in Vietnam was for naught. We just upset the country, I think, and corrupted it in many ways. And we should have never been in there. And I don't know if you know the story or not, how we got there, but it's... I know that when I was working in Vietnam and could see what was going on, I'd come home on leave and people would ask me about what was going on. I'd tell them, they'd just get mad at me. I knew all the time what was happening. I knew that the country was going to... that our efforts were worthless and that we weren't winning the hearts and the minds of the people, and that they were wasting lives and time and money. People didn't want to hear that, and they still don't. But we had no business being in there. The reason we're in Vietnam is because, well, back in the middle of the 1800s, the major countries of the world, like England, you know, of course, was in India, and France was in Africa. England, of course, was in Africa. Belgium was in Africa, and the French, with their superior firepower, went into Vietnam ostensibly to protect some missionaries that were there, and then they just simply took over the country. They renamed it French Indochina. They divided Vietnam into Tonkin China, Annam, and Cochin China, took over Laos and Cambodia, called it all French Indochina, and began to exploit the country for its resources. Didn't do a thing for the people, really. And of course, this was going on all over the world by the major countries. And of course, we weren't exempt ourselves. It was during this period of time that we acquired Hawaii and the Philippines, Cuba, some of the islands in the Pacific. But a spirit of nationalism began to grow amongst the natives. And by the time of World War II, this nationalism was well underway. The Vietnamese were tired of being exploited by the French, and they wanted them out. Well, World War II came along, and what happened in Vietnam was that the French were rounded up and, well, they were driven out of Vietnam, and the nationalists were delighted. The Japanese, of course, took control for a period of time, well, for 4 years. And the Japanese held sway in Vietnam. Well, of course, the Japanese lost the war. The Vietnamese nationalists were delighted. They said the French are gone, and now the Japanese are defeated. Now it's Vietnam for the Vietnamese. But they were wrong, because the French came back the next day, just about. And of course, we're all familiar with the struggle the French had in what they called Indochina. They had the same problems we had. The people back home were distressed that the lives were being lost, the money that was being spent. The French appealed to us repeatedly for help. We turned them down, saying we had no interest in that part of the world, and they'd have to fight their own battle. We finally relented in 1954 and sent them a few B-26s, which were used at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. But at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the French were utterly and decisively beaten by the Vietnamese nationalists, who were called Viet Minh at the time. And the French had to sue for peace, and now Vietnam could be for the Vietnamese. Well, under the leadership of John Foster Dulles at the Geneva Accords in 1954, a decision was made above and beyond the Viet Minh that Vietnam was going to be divided between the North and the South. And what had happened was that, I don't know whether you know it or not, but most of North Vietnam is Catholic. And the South originally was mostly Buddhist. But there are other religions too, such as the Wahao and the Kaodai. But I'm going to have to stop here a minute and tell you what happened in the meantime. We have to talk about the Kennedy family. You know, the Kennedy family are Irish roughnecks who, in the early days, made a lot of money by nefarious means, by bootlegging and whatnot. They're a staunchly Irish Catholic group. And they had very strong ties to Cardinal Spellman. It so happened that Cardinal Spellman
and Cushing.
Diem was one of the South Vietnamese mandarins who was kind of a religious fanatic. And he'd come to the United States, and he lived in, I think it was the Marian Old Seminary in New York for a period of time. And there's where he met Cardinal Spellman. And
Cushing.
Spellman that the communists, well, I guess Spellman maybe convinced him. The Catholics have always been leery of the atheistic, godless communists. And Ho Chi Minh and the other members of the Viet Minh did receive aid from China and the Soviet Union. And they were afraid that the North was going to be dominated by people who are anti-clerical. And so Spellman took Diem out to meet the Kennedys. And they became friendly. And of course, Diem had a lot of influence on John Kennedy, so that when he became president of the United States, he was more than willing to send a few advisors into South Vietnam. I remember when we had less than 500 advisors, but I saw it escalate from 500 to 650,000. Anyway, I think it was because of Kennedy's belief that the Catholics would be threatened with the ascendancy of the Viet Minh, who are closely tied in with the communists, that really got us involved in the war. That was John Foster Dulles, who